Well, just as the Earth's spin on its axis causes day and night, and our planet's annual orbit around the sun is responsible for the ongoing cycle of the seasons, what if there is some greater celestial cycle lasting thousands of years, slowly influencing the rise and fall of civilizations across the globe? Where's the evidence? What could be the cause? In a moment, we will talk with a very special guest, lost star of myth and time, Walter Cruttenden on Coast to Coast AM. Walter Cruttenden is an amateur theoretical archaeoastronomer. What a title! An author of The Binary Theory of Precession. As the executive rector of the Binary Research Institute, he researches the celestial mechanics of the precession of the equinox, as well as myth and folklore related to this phenomenon. He's the writer-producer of The Great Year, a documentary film that explores evidence of astronomical cycles of time known to cultures throughout the ancient world. Most recently, he wrote Lost Star of Myth and Time, a book that provides an alternative view of history based on the solar system's motion through space. It is his belief that the myth and folklore depicting a repeating cycle of golden ages and dark ages may have a basis in fact due to the alternating stellar forces that affect Earth as our solar system moves and a 24,000-plus-year binary dual-star orbit. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Walter, how are you?
Hey, great, George. How about yourself?
Good. And by the way, thank you for giving up an hour for our other guest. This was a very important subject in the fact that he believes that this period could be a holocaust for us. I just thought I had to talk with him a little more at length. So I appreciate it, and we'll make it up to you one day as well.
I understand.
This is a fascinating theory. As a matter of fact, one of my very favorite guests of all times talks about your book, and I want everyone to just have a little understanding of where we're headed here. Graham Hancock, Fingerprints of the Gods, writes, "Lost Star of Myth and Time is a wonderful, stimulating, thought-provoking new or very old approach to the oldest enigmas of human history. If Walter Cruttenden is right, as I very much suspect he is, then he has found the key to the mystery of the ages." That's a pretty good comment coming from Graham Hancock, my friend.
Yes, Graham is a great guy, and his book, Fingerprints of the Gods, was a bit of an inspiration to me. In that book, he talked about evidence of ancient civilizations, at which he found all over the world. And he kept running into the myth and folklore about the precession of the equinox, but he didn't quite know why. And then there's also another book you're probably familiar with, Hamlet's Mill.
Oh, yes.
By Giorgio Santolina, who was a professor of the history of science at MIT. And he too talked about the prevalence of this myth. As a matter of fact, he said there were at least 31 ancient cultures that talked about the great year cycle with golden ages and dark ages. But of course, we just grew up thinking it was myth and folklore. And you know, as a boy myself, I was just fascinated with ancient civilizations and read about Harappa and Mohenjo-daro and their fabulous civilizations and water systems, Mesopotamia, which all seemed to decline, of course, ancient Egypt that declined, and everything kind of went down into a dark age, and then the Renaissance came along, and things have been going up, at least technologically, since then.
At least so far, right?
Right. And of course, I got in school, and they taught me that, well, everything's just linear, so that just kind of glossed over these great civilizations that had declined all over the world.
What would have happened, Walter, had these great civilizations, which were doing some wonderful things in their own time period, had continued along that same progression?
Well, we'd probably be in a much different world now, but that's not consistent with the cycle of day and night. Day doesn't just continue forever. The seasons of spring and summer, change to fall and winter. and these are caused by celestial motions. Well, the ancients tell us this greater cycle, this precession of the equinox, this roughly 24 to 26,000 year cycle, is also caused by an orbital motion. And so, reading Graham's stuff, I could see he was getting at this issue of precession. So I just started studying it and set up the institute to do that. And finally, read every old text I could find and found that there was a fair amount of folks, especially through myth and folklore, talking about there being another star or a companion to the sun that drove this cycle, just like the cycle of the seasons is driven by an orbital motion.
How would they know that, Walter? Well, they didn't have telescopes, at least I don't think they did.
Well, that's true, although there has been some evidence of crystal lenses found and mm-hmm. other types of lenses, which Robert Temple goes into at great length in some of his books. But if indeed there was a higher age, then they may well have known things that were lost. For example, Aristarchus of Samos, the Greek who talked about the heliocentric system.
And what time period are we talking about?
This is about 400 or 500 BC.
All right.
And then that knowledge of a heliocentric system is lost for about 2,000 years until Copernicus rediscovers it in about 1500. We found the Babylon battery. There was knowledge of, how to store electrical energy. And that dates to at least 2 to 4,000 year BC, and that was lost.
As a matter of fact, that battery fascinates me because it was soldered, it had copper in it, it obviously had acid in it, which you need as an electrolyte. Somebody knew what they were doing.
Yes, yeah. Unfortunately, it was when it was found, it was moved out of context, so we really don't know the circumstances under which it was originally found.
And what about its purpose? What do you think they used it for?
It's hard to tell. It could be electrolysis to put metal coatings on jewelry, that sort of thing.
Could it have been a light bulb or something?
It could have powered a very low watt light bulb, but again, I wouldn't go that far just because we haven't found the light bulb. But there's all sorts of devices. How about the Antikythera device? This is this geared device. It was found in 1901, although really not realized until about 1950 when somebody dropped this encrusted hunk of metal in the museum, and it broke open, and they found out that it has at least 20 gears in it. And the shipwreck that it dates to is around 80 BC. Well, we were taught in school that gears weren't developed until the great clockmaking area, 12, 13, 1400s in there. And so there's a lot of these anomalous artifacts to hint at higher ages, long before the Dark Ages.
Might there have been, Walter, very high technology back even beyond what we think might have been normal civilizations, maybe 1 million years ago, 2 million years ago?
There might have been. I know that Cremo talks about that in his book, Forbidden Archaeology.
Right.
But I think we always want to extrapolate our own paradigm and figure that, a more advanced civilization would have better telephones or cell phones or computers or office buildings. And, maybe there's just a whole different paradigm if the ancients are right about these four ages, which the Greeks called the iron, bronze, silver, golden ages, and, the Vedic Indians had still different names for. They describe the higher age not so much as one where man is fascinated with technology. As a matter of fact, they hint that that's a very low age. They say higher ages, Hesiod in particular talks about this, is a time that man lives in tune with nature, and there's a very harmonious pattern that exists on the Earth. So, you know, I'm not sure that we're really going to find evidence of really fancy technology if we go way, way back in the record, although we certainly do find some things that were rediscovered in the Renaissance period.
Well, let's go back then to the beginning of your work and research, the precession of the equinox. Kind of explain what that is, first of all, if you can, Walter.
Sure. The equinox, of course, is that day of the year that the night and day are of equal length. And so it's used as a point of measurement. And if you, say, sat on one of the pyramids on that day and looked straight east over the Sphinx, you would see a particular constellation rising on, let's say, the spring equinox. And if this was about 2,000 years ago, you would have seen, or say 4,000 years ago, it would be Aries at that point. And then about 2,000 years, Pisces was just coming into view. And very soon, it's Aquarius. That's why they call it the dawning of the age of Aquarius. So this precession of the equinox, it's just a way to mark this our time in this vast cycle, this 24 to 26,000 years that it takes the equinox to precess through all 12 constellations that lie along the ecliptic, the ancient.
Now, why was this so important, let's say, to the ancient people?
Now, that is the big $64 question. Why does every ancient culture talk about this? And if it is just a mere wobbling of the Earth, it's hard to imagine why it would be important. But they also attach these great year myths to it. They hinted that it's a way to keep time where we are, closer to a dark age or a golden age. And we have found that precession, the observable precession, the equinox moving through these different constellations, can be produced not just by a wobbling Earth, but could actually be produced by the solar system curving through space. You can produce the same phenomenon.
Is it a clock of calamity, Walter? Do these events occur to a point where these ancients realize, something's going to be pretty catastrophic here, something's going to happen?
Well, many of the myths do hint at that, and especially the Assyrians, you know, they found over 100,000 cuneiform tablets, many of them at the museum in Nineveh, that date back quite some time. And they were actually in a descending age, unlike us now in an ascending age, and they hinted how the past was so wonderful and beautiful, and they wanted to recreate it. And when they recreated buildings, they tried to make them exact, and they dreaded the future. And sure enough, the world went into a dark age. Sumer, Akkad, Babylon were wiped off the face of the earth. And then, you know, after the dark age, we've had the Renaissance. And so we're, according to this clock, the ancients actually used the autumnal, the fall equinox rather than the spring equinox.
Okay, so the thrust of your theory is that the sun has another partner somewhere, right?
Yes, and it is this mass that is causing the solar system to curve through space, producing the phenomenon that we call the precession of the equinox. You know, what it is it's just a change in the orientation of the Earth. And think about Ptolemy's time. They saw the sun rise in the east and they set in the west, and so they were convinced the sun went around the Earth.
Sure.
You couldn't tell them otherwise. Hey, I can see it rise over there, set over there.
Yeah, we see it moving.
Yeah, tell me it doesn't move. And what they didn't realize was the Earth was spinning. Well, the same thing is occurring now. We've lost sight of a reference frame. Not only is the Earth spinning and orbiting the sun, but the entire solar system is curving through space, and it is that motion which produces the bulk of the observable of the precession of the equinox.
Does our solar system have its own orbit around something?
Yes, I believe it does. And, you know, 50 years ago, it was thought that binary star system, stars that orbit each other, orbit a common center of mass, were rare. And then 20 years ago, it was realized, wow, it's maybe half of all stars. And the latest estimate I just read on the NASA Chandra website is 80% of all stars are in binary or multiple systems. So you have to ask, you know, why wouldn't our sun be part of such a system?
Where would this other star partner be?
Well, we're trying to figure that out.
Can we see it with a Hubble, for example?
Well, what we can prove is that the Earth does not wobble the same amount relative to objects within the solar system that it does relative to objects outside the solar system. So it does show that our solar system is curving through space. And we know that it takes a very heavy mass to cause something as massive as our sun and solar system to, you know, change angular direction. So there's something there, and there's good scientists that are talking about this. Richard Muller at Berkeley, John Anderson has talked about it a little bit at Caltech JPL. But we don't see something that fits Newtonian mechanics. So in that scenario, one must assume that it is a brown dwarf, maybe a red dwarf against a galactic center.
Okay, which would be even more difficult to find.
Or something like that. There is a whole other scenario, though, for a possible visible star. But that takes us into the world of non-Newtonian dynamics. And there's a theory out there called MON, Modified Newtonian Dynamics, which is gaining some popularity.
Might this be the very bright star we see all the time?
It very well could be. As a matter of fact, there's quite a bit of a myth and folklore about a few stars. And
one being, of course, Sirius, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, Sirius was Isis to the Egyptians. Some would even say that it's Marduk or Nibiru.
Mm-hmm.
And it's relatively close, 8.6 light years away.
And others believe that an extraterrestrial race came to this planet from that star system.
I've heard some of that. I'm trying to stick to the hard physics of it all. And so we're still having an issue with how on Earth our system could get around Sirius in 24,000 years when Newtonian dynamics says it would take, you know, millions of years.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, but there are...
If that's true, how could that happen?
Well, there's some new theories of gravity out there that are quite interesting, that say we're going much faster than we have thought for...
What if we go through some kind of warp portal or something to get there? Is that possible? I don't, even a wormhole. Maybe we're not ripped apart like some people say we could be.
You know, I think it's probably simpler than that. Just intuitively, there's a scientist down at the University of Adelaide who has said that he believes our solar system might be going 450 to 500 kilometers a second.
Wow.
Which would get us around that point. Also, if you look at what's happened to some of our spacecraft as they near the edge of our solar system, Pioneer 10 and 11 specifically, they're not where they're supposed to be.
Right, that's true.
And, you know, this is a well-known phenomena, and there's lots of people are studying it. And so it could be that, you know, as Einstein said, the gravity works a little differently on a very large scale, and maybe it works a little differently than we think just outside our solar system.
Stay with us. We're going to talk more about this binary star system. The Mayans, the Hopis, they had a lot to say about this. And what about an ancient spark plug that was found? What's that all about? I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, at the top of the hour, we'll open up the phone lines with our guest, Walter Cruttenden. Already? That's right. And we're going to continue talking about some of these things that have affected this planet and will affect this planet. But I want to get in the Mayans and the Hopi as well, because that's fascinating reading. Back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with our guest, Walter Cruttenden. Walter, the Mayans, the Hopis, let's talk about the Mayans first. What did they say about these possibilities?
Well, both of them had different names for it. And we do talk about this a little bit in my book, Lost Star. But whereas the Vedic Indians called it Yugas, the Greeks called it Ages, the Hopis called it Suns, and or worlds, and the Mayans called it suns. So I think the Mayan is the fifth sun, and we're hearing a lot about that now in the with the 2012.
Right, we're getting close to that
phenomena. We sure are, yeah. And I'll say up front that I don't know really what that means, but I do find it amazing that the Mayans could so long ago get very close to the date of this alignment of the winter solstice, December 21st, 2012, with the galactic center. Because even NASA confirms that that happens roughly between 1990 and 2020, depending on where you pinpoint the galactic center.
Is it possible that 2012 might not be the date for whatever is to occur, if anything? Or do you think they've got it?
Well, I think they used it as a marker, just as other civilizations use the equinoxes or solstices for markers. And they seem to have the same mythology about changes coming with the changing of the ages. And so it could be that, you know, they had enough memories or mythology of prior cycles, ages, to be able to determine that this when the winter solstice aligns with the galactic center, we're at a point where there's a critical mass of change. And I think something is going on.
Is it physical change? Is it spiritual change? What do you think they meant?
I'm not sure, but if you look at just sort of the outward evidence, there's sure a rapid expansion in technology. So man's consciousness seems to be expanding, and it shows up as we can invent more stuff. Also, there's interchanges in that it seems more and more people are interested in higher consciousness, meditation. You know, in the 50s and 60s when I grew up, it was just starting to be talked about. And then I read in Time magazine just the other day, 18 million people are meditating now just in the U.S. So something's going on where more and more people seem to be, reflecting and getting in touch on a deeper level.
Well, now, do you think that the fact that there's a binary star system, are we talking about catastrophes that have and will occur because of this dual star system?
You know, while some of the myth and folklore does make reference to past catastrophes, you know, that the world would be destroyed by flood or fire, that sort of thing. Certainly the flood myth is one of the most prevalent. Here in the ascending ages, they talk about, different levels of being or consciousness more so. And I thought the Greeks put it the best, the iron, bronze, silver, and golden age. It's even mentioned in the book of Daniel and in the Bible. But the lowest age, the Vedic Indians would tell us, is just man's only aware of his physical body and the physical universe, no knowledge of finer forces. And we came out of that just in the last few hundred years with the Renaissance. And at that point, man is supposed to become aware of finer forces. And sure enough, electricity is discovered, magnetism, a microscope, telescope. It seems like all our senses are expanded outwardly through technology.
Well, what's the significance, though, of a binary star system? I don't understand what the tie-in is.
It is the drivetrain. It is the mechanism to move us, to carry the Earth in and out of some point in space where the Earth can be affected in such a way that it would affect the ionosphere, the magnetosphere, crops, climate, consciousness, all that sort of thing.
So it will affect us in some form or fashion.
Yes, and I think it is affecting us. It, just as the sun, you know, every star produces huge electromagnetic spectrums, and we only see visible light coming from our closest star, the sun. But there are, you know, ultraviolet to infrared, to X-rays, to radio waves, gamma waves, et cetera. And so do all other stars have these properties. And so if we are in a system that is pulling us closer to and farther away from another star on sort of a cyclical basis, because that's what elliptical orbits do,
right,
then we could very well be affected by another star in a manner that affects Earth. And, you know, we've just found out, you know, that these X-class solar flares from our sun can have a big impact. You know, they knock out satellites, ham radios get static.
Sure.
Your car radio changes. Well, just in the last few years, people have noticed that that happens on the night side of the Earth. We are getting bursts from, most of them have been traced to soft gamma repeaters, you know, very distant stars. And it can have the same effect as a solar flare in that it can affect satellites, ham radios. There was a gal in Seattle driving home at night. She switched to a Nebraska station. Believe me, the stars can have just as much effect on our Earth as the sun can.
Well, maybe they're also having an effect on the sun.
Yes.
See, what I think is happening in terms of all these hurricanes and global warming and the oceans warming up, and now there's a research study that's out that says this could be a strong possibility. I think the sun is doing a lot of this, not planetary change, but the sun itself. I think the sun is causing the ice shelves to melt and fall off into the sea.
Yes, and there could be a relay effect, George. I think you're right on. Matter of fact, Hans Alfven won the Nobel Prize in 1970 for his realization that there's these waves coming from other stars, Alfven waves they're called, that sort of can interact with our sun and just pluck the Earth and sort of, you know, ring it like a gong, if you will. So we're barely at the kindergarten stage of learning of how the Earth's environment and space can affect things here
sure.
on Earth.
And it's possible the binary star could be affecting us as well as maybe we get closer to it?
It could be the binary star itself, because all binaries move in elliptical orbits, so we get closer and farther from the center of mass. But it could also be that it's the binary motion just takes us closer and then farther away from another point in space. You know, maybe it's a magnetar, this recently discovered star that has a magnetic field 1,000 trillion times greater than the Earth. You know, it could be some exotic star like that that affects the Earth.
Have the ancients given us any clues, Walter, to help us find what could be the second star?
Well, you know, some of the myth and folklore does relate to Sirius, as mentioned. So if it's a visible star scenario, we need to figure out how that can happen with, you know, what the laws of gravity are outside our solar system that might make that possible. So we're really studying both scenarios right now, sort of the pure Newtonian scenario where it could be something dark, or this this more exotic one. There's also some friends in Canada have a website, SiriusResearchGroup.com, and they're studying Sirius, and they've done really some amazing work to show that it seems to be acting a little differently than other stars.
The ability of this binary star to do whatever it does to us, of course, could it have been the reason that we had the flood, the Noah's Ark flood, and things like that?
I'm not sure of that, but there is some work by the Russian scientist Milankovitch who showed that these dark ice ages seem to occur somewhat in sync with the precession cycle. And there's also some other cycles. There's a 100,000-year cycle.
Okay.
So if indeed precession, the observable of precession, is due to our solar system's orbit through space, then it would tie with that cycle also.
What do the Hopis now say about this?
The Hopis have passed down some myth and folklore, and they say that, you know, I believe we're going from the fourth world to the fifth world, so it's quite similar to the Mayans.
There are similarities. That's what's fascinating all by itself.
It is, yes. The Hopis do get into more detail, though, just because they're more of an existing culture, whereas the Maya were virtually wiped out. And so they talk about...
By the way, for an intelligent race like the Mayans, for what I call a super race at the time, for them to get wiped out, that's a little boggling all by itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Boy, you know, they really succumb to some of the Dark Age influences there. Plus, you know, when the white man came over, it probably finished whatever the last vestiges.
Sure, or probably brought disease and things like that.
Were there, yes. There's some stories about that.
Well, back to the Hopi myth.
So, yes, the Hopis talked about there being a very beautiful world in prior times, that there were cities that are now under the seas. You know, a lot of these myths, they're not really explicit, but they seem to hint at a higher age in prior times.
Like an Atlantis-type age?
It sure sounds a lot like that.
It does.
They don't use that word Atlantis, but it sounds very similar to what we have learned of Atlantis through Plato.
Of course, you know, in some of the Vedics, I mean, they talked about flying machines. I mean, so you could be talking about real high technology.
Very possibly, yes. But also maybe a man himself is, you know, of an expanded consciousness in a higher age, and therefore just much more in tune with nature. And so I'm not sure that we need all the outward technology, but we're studying all the myth and folklore we can on this right now.
Walter, tell us about the incredible story that's in Lost Star about this spark plug. I mean, this is a great story.
Well, that's one item, and we've tried to put hundreds in there, and I'm not sure that every single one is true, but in the book Lost Star, which, by the way, people can get at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, there's this geode that somebody found and cut open, and there's a device in it that looks a lot like a spark plug.
And how old do you think it could have been?
Well, geodes would take, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to form.
Okay.
So, unfortunately, the exact circumstances under which it was found are not super clear. So, if indeed it was a geode, then it's very, very old and quite interesting. If it is not a geode, then, you know, then I would.
That's G-E-O-D-E-S, right?
G-E-O-D-E, I believe geode.
Okay. And we'll do a little work on that. Right. But if it was a spark plug, what the heck would it be used for? Do they have old cars in those days?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, when you find things like the Babylon battery, you asked what that was used for. Clearly, they had the ability to create and store electrical charge there. That is a most interesting question.
And I do think the Baghdad battery could have been used as some electroplating device.
Very possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've sure found a lot of...
But to have the knowledge of that, that's the fascinating part of the story.
And to have it go away, too. You know, I think it shows that there's somewhat of a cycle we're seeing in history here, of course.
Because when did the battery pop back up again? 16th century?
Yes, exactly. 16, 1700s by Volta.
So almost a couple thousand years, easy. I mean, this battery could be 2000 BC. It could be 4,000 years. that technology was lost.
Yes, yeah, same thing with gears, the ability to make arches, sophisticated water systems, you know, all these things are lost and through the Dark Ages and then rediscovered in the Renaissance. And that's why history just didn't make sense to me, what I was being taught in school, and I needed to look for something else that made sense, more of a cycle. And this cycle of the, which Plato called the Great Year, was dominant throughout virtually every ancient culture. And it was really only since, you know, Darwin that we got the purely linear cycle.
What do you think of the work of Zachariah Sitchin?
I've read his stuff, and I think that he's done a great job at recognizing many of the discoveries of the ancient, particularly the Sumerians, where he talks about the trepanation devices for brain surgery, which they've actually found, you know, the physical devices. I do disagree with the orbital mechanics of the hypothesized Nibiru. As a matter of fact,
3,600-year elliptical orbit, right?
Right, and something coming within the solar system perturbing the paths of the other planets, just it doesn't make sense. It wouldn't last. It would be ejected or destroyed very quickly. Also, I think you're familiar with Michael Heiser.
Oh, sure. Michael's been on the program a number of times.
Right, so he has an alternative explanation for what Nibiru might be, and
yeah.
He says, of course, that it's a star, and I looked at his work and Sitchin's work side by side, and I really think Kaiser has nailed it. It is a star, but this language, crossing, it seems to cross, and so that is the classic definition of a binary star. It would move against the grain, so to speak.
Well, do you believe, though, that this planet could have been visited by ancient extraterrestrials?
I think anything is possible, particularly if we were in a higher age at that time. It might have been a more desirable place to come than currently, when it may not be quite as desirable.
Well, but it might have been safer then, that's for sure.
Yes, yeah. But, you know, there's stories about these things. I just... I'm trying to stick to sort of the known science right now.
It's not easy just to contain yourself into that arena, though, is it?
No, it's not. But I tell you, the whole internet is causing this spontaneous collaboration. So just working on the book Lost Star, you know, I've been able to get a hold of astronomers, astrophysicists, people all over the world and collaborate on different aspects of that.
Do you have much support for the binary star theory?
I think it is getting a fairly good audience if I can get enough time to talk to people. And I've filed a few papers on this, on the geometric theory of precession, and just met with some Caltech JPL folks the other day. So it's going to take a while, but we are making some headway.
All right, Walter. Well, let's tap the brain of our Coast to Coast audience and open up the phone lines for you. We'll be back in a moment. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.